This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 450 for February 1 of 2019. Ed Welburn talks car design. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
All right, After Hours. Gary, how you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm still getting over something I picked up at the Detroit Auto Show.
Yeah, that happens.
So if you hear me cough during the show, it's still part of that.
You know, many years ago, you made a speech at Management Briefing Seminar about how the Detroit automakers transformed their production capacity from making cars to making munitions and airplanes and things like that. And it struck me today, in 1942, was the last day that production vehicles for private citizens were made during the wartime. And I was thinking, damn, John.
This day, 1942. Yeah, no kidding.
January 31st, 1942.
Great trivia. Great trivia. Yeah.
But it reminded me of your presentation. So, huh. You know, it sticks with people.
Huh. Interesting. We got to let everybody know the auto extremist is in the house. Peter DeLorenzo, man. Great having you
here.
Good
to see you guys.
Yeah, great having you here. And our special guest, Ed Welburn.
Former, it's good to be here.
Former vice president of GM Global Design.
Yeah.
What do you call yourself these days?
Car designer.
Car designer. So you're still designing?
Well, I'm still designing. I sketch every day. And I've got a number of other projects besides designing that I'm involved in.
Like what? Can you tell us?
I'm executive producer of a movie.
What?
And I'm writing a book.
Wow.
Oh. I've got a couple book projects. And then
so the book's about your career or what?
Yeah, the book is about the career, and it's I got to tell you, whether it gets published or not, it was so much fun to write all this stuff.
Really? That's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's 44 years at GM, you know. And plus, I mean, the years leading up to that, a lot of work. But man, it is. I recommend that everyone do that.
Write a book about themselves.
Yeah. Just,
or their career.
Just to capture all of that is cool.
And the movie? What's the movie?
Oh, I can't talk about the movie.
Oh, interesting.
I've probably told you too much.
All right, so I've got to ask you. So you're sketching every day now.
Yes.
Okay. When you were at General Motors running design,
yes.
Did you sketch every day?
Well, it's a yes and no thing because when I was leading design, I would sketch all the time, but I never shared the sketches with the studio team. That's the absolute worst thing that a leader of design can do, because you take the sketch in, they see it, all the designers gravitate to it, they stop creating, and I'm not going to be in this studio every day to do the follow-up sketches. I've seen it happen, during my career, and I just swore that I would never share them. But I sketched on most of the projects. It would help me get into the mindset, understand the challenges they're going through if I sketched myself.
You're probably sketching when you're on a phone call.
Or in a meeting. Yes.
An executive board meeting. Yes. Drawing cars.
Yes.
So you've got projects now with car companies or what? I mean, who's coming to you? You can't tell me that either.
I feel as though my world today is maybe more confidential than it was when I was at GM. No, but I am working on a car project, and it's not with, one of the car companies. I'm not even sure if many people would actually see the end result of this car project.
Oh,
it's
okay.
That exclusive.
Hey, one sec. I got to let our guests know, our viewers know. If you want to get in on the conversation, shoot us an email right now. Send it to viewermail@outofline.tv. Try to keep them short. The shorter they are, the more likely we are to get to them. Same with the phone calls. We'll take phone calls as well. And that number is 620-288-6546. And are you following us on social media? Check it out. We're at Out of Line on Twitter. We're at the Out of Line Network on Facebook and also at Out of Line Network on Instagram. And you can stay up with us with the latest stuff that we're posting. Okay, back to talking to Ed here. And we got a bunch of questions already coming in. Look at that. Oh, my gosh.
So, Ed, what happened to GM Design since you left?
You know, I have not spent much time there. I've only been back there once. And, you know, I was really looking at some projects that I was involved in. You know, there's still a couple cars, one in particular that hasn't come out yet that I was very much involved in. And the next generation of Corvette. And so I spent time with that. And that's been about it. I haven't been back, you know. It's and I miss the people.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, you know, design's the kind of thing. You have to be all in or not. And
yeah.
And last thing they need is for me to, they don't need yet another opinion on the work they're doing.
Right. And, I just, the XT6 was so disappointing for me. I don't know.
I think it's, you know, it's, yeah, it's funny. I think it's the absolute right vehicle for the market that size.
Oh, they, no question, they needed that vehicle.
Yeah, they needed it. I think the market's looking for that size vehicle. It's a challenging vehicle to design.
Yeah, and I don't think Cadillac put enough exclusive Cadillac stuff in it.
The thing that's so interesting right now is that, and I was thinking about it on the way over here as I was in traffic behind a Kia. And, you know, so you've got that, you've got Chevy, you've got Ford, they're doing a great job on SUVs. It presents quite a challenge to not only Cadillac, but Bentley, Rolls-Royce, Maserati, all of them, to do something that is significantly better than those SUVs. They're good. They're doing a good job on the moderately priced vehicles.
So when you have the ability to do a Cadillac or a higher-level vehicle, I mean, what can design affect in terms of making it special?
Well, that's the challenge. I mean, because, you know, in particular with an SUV, because, you know, you have the basic box area, the cargo area and interior compartment. That's one box. And then you got the front end, and how wildly different can you make it? How different can you make the proportions? You know, in the past, mm-hmm. a luxury sedan had a long dashed axle, and its proportions were significantly different than a conventional car. It had 12 or 16 cylinders. And so when you get to an SUV, that it becomes a challenge. I still think there's more that they can and should do from a proportion perspective to separate them.
How would you do that?
It would be dash to axle.
Dash to axle. So dash to axle. Really calls for rear-wheel drive then. Or as you get into these or electric cars, the skateboard gives you a far more.
Exactly. Design. Exactly. I think you move around the components in a very different way to achieve a very different proportion. But I think the very high-end SUVs have got to separate themselves from some really good, moderately priced vehicles.
Well, design is going to be the ultimate initial product differentiator forever.
Yeah.
I mean, you get a bunch of electric vehicles in a segment. The design is going to be the thing that...
Yeah. It's, you know, you say it, Bob Lutz would always say it, Sloan always said it, be the great differentiator. In Sloan's time, it was, you know, one car company comes out with electric starter, eventually everyone will have it, or everyone will have an automatic transmission.
Right.
Design's the great differentiator.
Even with autonomous cars, I believe.
Oh, I think so. And I'm excited about the potential with autonomous vehicles, electric vehicles.
Especially the interior of
yeah.
autonomous, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Although, you know, everyone talks about, oh, they're just going to be the, in fact, Lutz talks about this, they're going to be these anonymous pods. And
I haven't had that conversation with him in at least 6 months.
You know? before we go down this autonomous and electric road too far, I mean, one of the things that, you know, I was looking over what you accomplished when you were at General Motors, and you really internationalized design at that organization. And the thing that I wonder about is, what are the effects of that? I mean, when you have a studio in Korea, and you have a studio in Shanghai, and you have a studio in Germany, and you have a studio in Detroit, I mean...
I think that there were a lot of attempts to do global cars in the 80s and 90s, and it didn't work. It's because those cultures were so different from each other, radically different. There are still those differences, but there's an awful lot that's the same. The internet has really brought everyone together. There are those subtle differences that you can't ignore, but in many ways, everyone's looking for the same thing, and maybe the scale's different, the size of the vehicle. But I was able to leverage the creative talent of all of these designers and sculptors all over the planet, basically. And they all had their assignments, but every now and then there might be a project that the studio in Brazil needed help, you know, and maybe the studio in China or India or the U.S. could help them, and that was very powerful.
So is it conceivable that car companies that we may not be familiar with, or we only know what the acronym is, sort of, that may be in China or
yes,
wherever else, India, what have you.
That builds incredible numbers of vehicles, and we don't even know about them
right
here in the States, yeah.
So could they conceivably hire people from General Motors or from Ford or from FCA or whoever else and, you know, create something with design? I mean, as Peter's saying, I mean, that's the differentiator. I mean,
they could, and they have. And I would say 10 years ago, they needed to hire people from Europe or the States to create quality design. But the designers in China today are so good. And, you know, it's 20 years ago, most of the designers in China would basically copy what their boss was sketching. The lead designer, they all followed, you know. But now they really work as individuals, and the creativity is unbelievable. I think they're some of the most talented designers on the planet.
In China. That's a statement.
At least in the General Motors studio.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the last time I was there, would have been over 2 years ago, the work was just phenomenal. Phenomenal.
So would their designs play in Peoria?
Yeah, I think they would. I just look at the Baojun brand, you know, which is part of Wuling, and their latest SUVs are unbelievable. And again, they look very expensive, and you know, it's kind of the challenges to the more premium SUVs. You've got a Baojun sitting there that looks, you know, really strong.
Yeah, and it's probably only 10 grand.
Yeah, exactly. And they're just selling like crazy.
Where are these designers coming from? Are they going to school in the U.S. and Europe and places, or does China have its own design schools?
They have their own design schools, but a lot of their designers are coming here. A lot of them are at CCS, right?
Right here in Detroit.
Yeah. Or Art Center in California. Yeah.
What production designs of late do you like?
I think Volvo's doing some good things. You know, I really like them. You see a Volvo coming, the front end, the side looks great. Then you see the rear, and you say, they still have work to do.
Yeah.
the rear of their cars are just... It's like
I just went to lunch at some point.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the clock stopped, and yeah. But other than that, I really, really like what they're doing. You know,
they're on a roll right now.
Yeah.
Volvo is. It's amazing
yeah.
to see how quickly they're coming back.
Sure.
Their smallest crossover I like. I don't
XC40. Know.
XC40. Yeah. XC40,
yeah.
You can order it with the different color roof and
right.
the...
Two-tone. Two-tones are making something of a comeback.
Yeah,
right. Yeah.
Pretty,
yeah.
pretty striking.
Well, it's just, I mean, there's so many fashion trends that go full circle, but like I always say, you know, you could, and the same in the fashion design, it goes full circle, but don't dare wear the older version of it because...
Yeah. yeah. Here we got the picture of the XC40 up right,
right
now, but
yeah.
Jeep Compass does the same thing. Even Toyota Camry does a two-tone right,
right
now. So it's kind of cool. But it's only the roof. It's only the eight pillars
yeah.
in the roof that
yeah.
they're doing.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, really, it was Land Rover that started that whole trend of the contrasting roof panel. And for some cars, it's easy to do. It depends on how it's manufactured. For others, it's really difficult.
That's typically why it's only the roof.
Yeah.
It's relatively
yeah.
easy
yeah.
to do. I say relatively.
Relative.
The manufacturing
it, but,
people
but it
don't
depends
like
on how the roof is manufactured. Some cases it's really tough to do the
Volvo people tell me that that's really tough to do. And so
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I was looking over it, I mean, so I've got like a page and a half of cars that you were involved with, single spaced over the years. I mean, it is absolutely phenomenal, the cars that you did. What are some of your favorites?
I have my favorites, and there are a couple I'd like to have back. But
and tell us what those are, too.
Yeah, well, I will, you know, and I think there's a good story there. But just bringing back Camaro was a big deal. And it wasn't just bringing back Camaro. It's the fact that Chevrolet was very vanilla at the time, very vanilla, all the way across the board. And when we did Camaro, when we brought the concept back and which led to production, it just told everyone internally that Chevrolets could be exciting. They could have flair. They could have some energy. And everyone, yeah, and that car, photos of that car you'd see in the studios around the world. It could be a small studio in Brazil that did Chevrolets, but there is a photo of the Camaro, and it kind of became their guiding star or something.
Yeah. Hey, in fact, we got a question here real quick from C-Tech. He wants to know, should Chevrolet abandon the 1969 influence and move on?
Should Porsche abandon the 911 from the 1970s influence? I don't know. Should they? You know. Should Corvette abandon the influence of the 59 Stingray Racer, 1959 Stingray Racer?
Still my all-time favorite car.
You know?
As long as you're mentioning Corvette, Adonis Carr says, did you like the last version you saw of the C8?
I'm number one, I liked everything I saw, but I have to be cautious in how I answer that question, don't I?
Well, you do, because GM will not even admit there's a C8 out there.
Yeah, but
even though
know,
we've seen videos of the cars at the Nürburgring and Sebring.
Yes, but you know, it's just like, of course there will be a next generation of a Silverado. Or of course there will be a next generation. I'm not talking at all about what the design is or its content or anything like that. I'd never do that. That would be giving away, you know, plans for future vehicles. But, you know, wouldn't you think there'd probably be a next-generation Corvette of some configuration?
Mid-engine, specifically.
As
yeah.
I said last,
I didn't say that. You said
I know. I said.
As I said last week, if the day that GM design can't do a Corvette is the day they have to hang it up, I'm confident it'll be a great-looking car.
It's yeah.
Okay, Gary raised the issue. And you said it. There's some that you'd like to have back, and you said there's a good story behind that.
Probably the car. I tell you, wait and read my book. But the 1988 Cutlass Supreme, the W cars, and Cutlass Supreme has sold so strong. Generation after generation, you know, at one point, it sold 500,000 units in 1 year.
I want to say a million.
You know, and well, I'm just thinking of the Supreme, but there's so many variants right. of it. But so when we did the W car, total.
Is this it right here?
No, that's the generation before. That was still a very strong selling car. Yeah. 88 is when the front drive, transverse front drive, mid-size cars were done.
It had that real different backlight.
It's very rounded, and the glass attempted to be a wraparound glass or glass-to-glass roof line. The challenge, and the Edict was a really push hard. Remember, you had Audi 5000 came out very aero look, followed by the Taurus, and there had been a lot of concept cars from Pininfarina and from GM and Chrysler of these very aero rounded. A lot of people call them jelly bean cars. Mm-hmm. And Roger Smith really wanted us to push hard. And there was a concept that GM had that was down at Epcot. It's called Aero 2000. He said it should be as advanced as that car. So we started sketching, and I was one of the designers in the studio sketching, and I wanted the sketches to be that advanced. It really kind of leapfrogged everything. It just went too far. Too far. The interior didn't go far enough. It was like the previous generation interior. The exterior went too far, and I don't think we were prepared. Yeah, there it is. Oh, with me, in fact. So I can't say I wasn't there. And that's really that particular car, the Pace car, is probably the best it ever looked, but. Most of them that are on the street had smaller wheels, and they weren't two-toned. And I just think it led the market too far.
Was that an example of the CEO driving design then?
Well, it was like I think most designers liked what they heard from the CEO, and they took off and did something very advanced. Market research over and over again. Hated the car. Whenever they asked customers, they hated the car.
Well, design reach is a very fine line.
It absolutely.
As you know full well, it's a very fine line.
It's a challenge, and I never forget one day Tommy Hilfiger came to visit, and we had toured the studios, and we're sitting in my office, and he asked me what the lead times were, because in his industry, it's like 1 year, 18 months. It's the lead time in the fashion industry. Even less, they can do things in 6 months.
Yeah.
And when I told him, it could be, depending on the project, it could be 4 years, maybe even five. And then it has got to stay fresh in the market for another 4 years of production, right? 4 or 5 years. So we've got to think almost 10 years in advance. He looked at me like I was nuts. I thought he was going to spit on me or something. He just thought I was crazy. He said, how do you anticipate that? There's so many things that change in the world. And how do you do it? That's the challenge.
But there's also a challenge, isn't there, in the head of design really fighting for design,
yeah.
which I believe you did.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's been other examples at GM where...
Well, Bill Mitchell was the most famous one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there are those who fought and those who pushed hard. Fighting and pushing hard are a couple different things. And then there are those who got along. And... some of the fights are legendary, and the car lost. And there were those who really pushed hard and, worked in collaboration, and some strong things happened, good things happened.
One of the reasons I'm getting to this is you said the clinic on that 88 Oldsmobile did not clinic well. People hated it. When Ford did the
original... You said clinic. I said clinics. This thing, I think almost everyone in America... had seen the car in a clinic, one clinic after another clinic. And they kept telling us over and over, this car is wrong. And we just kept pushing forward, searching for someone else to show it to.
But when Ford did the original Taurus and Sable, they did not clinic well.
Yeah.
In fact, the stories I always heard was Red Poling, who was running the company then, had a big gulp.
Yeah.
But design kept saying, no, this is the right thing, and it went on to be a smash hit.
Yeah.
So how do you balance that when you're getting bad feedback, but your gut tells you?
Well, it depends on how you interpret the feedback. I actually like the market research, the clinics. It's just how you interpret what you hear, and then you still, at the end of the day, have to make the decision of what you're going to do, what you may adjust or not. But you can't be a slave to it.
What is your sense of the fact that the sedan market seems to be going away, and that, you know, you were talking earlier about the difficulty of differentiating design for SUVs? They all pretty much look the same.
Let's talk about that. And then the thing is, though, it's one thing that is going away, that the big question is, what's next? It's easy to talk about what is happening today or what happened last year, but what's next? Because SUVs are super strong now. But I did a study really looking at the evolution of the automobile from really its very beginnings, when basically you took a wagon and added a motor of some type to it, and it gradually evolved into this closed sedan of the 30s. And then Harley Earl, one of my heroes, kept pushing for lower, wider, longer.
The wide
and it kept
job.
Getting lower. And the station wagon, derivatives of it, became so impractical because the roof came down so much. You could carry 2x4s, but not very many, you know, in a wagon from the 1960s. And basically SUVs are the same dimension as the sedan from the 1930s. If you really look at a late 1930s sedan, and you look at your typical crossover of today, they're the same.
So why not design a crossover to look, I mean, kind of like what Chrysler did with the PT Cruiser. Maybe you don't have to go to that retro of a look, but you could get a totally different silhouette.
Yeah, I think so. And I think
they had an HHR.
I think some of the SUVs, or part of the evolution will be to probably bring them down a bit more to make it easier to get in and out of, with a growing elderly population. Getting in and out of an SUV is difficult for them.
They're too
high. Very difficult.
Up.
Climbing up into them. So I think as SUVs start to come down, to make it easier for them, a large population that will still want to be mobile. I mean, I think that will have an influence.
But, I mean, isn't one of the arguments that is often put out there in terms of why SUVs are so popular is because of the high H point that so many people, you know, especially in this area, are rolling around in full-size pickup trucks.
Yeah.
That if you're in anything that isn't high up, you can't see anything.
Right, exactly. And I usually drive sedans or Corvettes and... Yeah, and it's tough, you know, when you're in a lower vehicle. So, yeah, the high vehicles are strong, but it's going to be tough for elderly people to get in and out of them.
I think pickup trucks have reached parade float stage. I mean, they're just so massive.
I think this is why we're seeing a revival of the so-called midsize, which are still pretty big trucks.
Yeah,
but it's because the full-size have gotten to be too big for many
people. Well, you know, it is part of, I mean... It would be fun to chart all of it because the midsize is kind of where full-size trucks were, you know, in the 60s, 60s or 50s.
So are trucks interesting to design? I mean,
they are.
More so than cars?
They really are. I wouldn't say more so. They're interesting to design, and what's interesting, the truck studios are different, and the people that are in the studio are a bit different. They absolutely love designing trucks. And that blended the functionality that they have and then the whole aesthetics of them. And you know, not all trucks are the same. GMCs are a bit different from Chevrolets. And
I was so excited about the H4 Hummer when you guys were still doing Hummer. I love that. And it's painful that GM, I mean...
That was the little Hummer pickup.
Yeah. Well, no, the H4 was...
HX is what...
Yeah, it was HHX. Yeah.
And, yeah, I...
Is that one of the...
I love that.
The good ones that never got built?
Yeah.
Oh, it was a good one. I thought it was sensational.
Yeah.
Hey, we're going to have to take a quick commercial break here, but one question from the audience. Louis F. Forey, I hope I said that right, he's the president of the Society of Automotive Historians, says, Mr. Welborn, why has GM abandoned the low waistline that offers great visibility and enhanced sleekness?
I wouldn't say that the low belt line made the vehicle more sleek. If anything, I thought it slowed your eye going across the design. It was nice from an interior perspective, the view, the outward view. And I think some of our cars have really gotten pretty slim. Auto industry in general, not any particular brand. To increase that cabin, that side glass would be a good thing. It wouldn't necessarily make the vehicle look more sleek, though.
Gotcha. Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break here, give a shout-out to our friends that sponsor this show, and we'll be back in just a minute talking more with Ed Welborn.
The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry. We create innovative mobility technologies that reduce energy consumption and emissions while improving performance. Our proven track record has made us an industry leader in forward-looking propulsion solutions for combustion, hybrid, and electric vehicles.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
All right, we're back talking design with Ed Welborn. Ed, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is new technology for design. Sean, what was the name of that?
Gravity Sketch.
So Ford did this whole thing about using augmented reality where you design in augmented reality. And one of the things it's claiming is that because you've got full view of the entire design as you're sketching, it helps creativity. Just wonder what some of your thoughts are about some of this new technology coming into
design. Is this where I take my nap or what? Seriously, I mean, I get excited about it as well. And the time I'd spend in virtual reality is exciting. And the tools, anything that stimulates creativity is good. But at the end of the day, you know, it's got to be a very creative person at the end of that wand or that stick or that pencil or that pen to do the work. And it's funny, so many designers... off to the side, they still have a little pad where they doodle. They do a little bit of their thinking, and then they go back to the computer to develop it. So, if that tool helps, great.
So but it's still going to be
end of the day, you're not going to be driving that down the street, you know. So if it helps, cool, but it doesn't impress me.
So... is the ability to sketch something you think that all aspiring car designers ought to have? I mean, I'm sure that there are lots of people who ask you questions or they say, oh, my son or my daughter is wants to become a car designer, Mr. Welborn. How do I get this person? I mean, is that a fundamental thing that people ought to have?
Oh, absolutely. And it's so competitive. I mean, at the base or at the root of all of it is the ability to sketch, to draw, to make your ideas visible. And, they're incredible schools. CCS has got an incredible program, and great designers come out of that, other schools as well. And they all spend a lot of time sketching, and they spend time, a lot of time, sketching in the computer. So sketching is a broad topic. It's not just pen and paper. Mm-hmm. It's sketching in any form of format in the computer as well. But to be able, the key is being able to make your idea visible to your client, whoever that is.
You're mentioning Harley Earl, and I just, there's a biography that just came out about him, and which I recently read. So I was thinking, so here's a guy who basically comes from Hollywood.
Yes.
And this is not about the executive producing of this movie that you're doing or your starring role in Transformers Age of Extinction that I'm sure we all watched. But what I'm wondering about is, so you guys opened a studio out there in basically in Hollywood. Why? You know,
In recent years?
It was what, like 15, 20 years ago when you guys
did that studio? Yeah, we had a couple studios out there. Yeah.
So was the idea that there would be some different vibe there than here?
I think the vibe, the automotive culture was very different there. And in many ways, a bit more international. There's the old California thing. There was a whole Pacific Rim influence there as well. The movie industry was also important, and we had a link to it, worked with them quite a bit. So there were a number of things that made California attractive. And at the time, it was very hard to get anyone from California to come to Detroit. They just wouldn't do it. And, it was that serious. And that has changed significantly. It has really changed. I mean, people really, really want to come.
Is that because of the renaissance of the city?
Yeah. They 20 years ago, no one wanted to come to Detroit. It was tough duty, tough job to try to get somebody.
So as it's 3 degrees outside right now here in Detroit, how do you attract these Californians to come here?
Well, it's a cool city. Detroit is cool. There's a lot going on that there's a lot to like here. And that is attracting a lot of people, not just from California, but from around the world. I mean, it's not the problem that it was just a few years ago.
And especially attractive to the creative class. We're seeing a lot of artists and performance people and like coming here.
A whole city, you know, centered around art and design is very much a part of it.
You know, one of the things I've often wondered about, I mean, we could look up an assembly plant and see how many people work there, and we could, you know, I mean, there are these metrics for things. On a global basis, how many car designers are there? Do you get any idea?
No, I don't. I mean, you know, the GM organization had like 2,500 people, of which maybe 500 were designers, 400 to 500. And there are far more sculptors than there are designers. And there really aren't that many great schools for sculptors. It's tough finding really, really good sculptors, whether they're hands-on clay sculptors or sculptors who are sculpting in the computer. And our competition for the digital sculptors are really the movie industry and other forms of design or areas of design.
That surprises me that clay continues to exist. I mean, that
it always surprises people who don't work in the studio.
And why is that?
It's
the best part of design business, as far as I'm concerned.
It's just there's so much emotion around a clay model.
Well, you
so
feel it,
passion.
Right?
There you go.
I mean,
you feel it, you push it, you move it, you manipulate it. You know, you walk around it, you make adjustments here and there. And
that smells great.
You know, it's great, yeah.
Well, you know, it's like a great sculpture, pure art, you know, from a Moore or a de Kooning or whatever. You want to go and touch it.
Yeah, exactly. And so even if you're designing the whole car in the tube and the computer, to mill it out and then walk around it, it's always an exciting moment. Whether you're milling it out in clay, if you mill it out in clay, then you can then make some further refinements or adjustments, or a hard model, you know, is exciting. I worked at Bertone for a while. As a GM employee, we're working on a project at Bertone probably around 25 years ago. And at Bertone, they didn't use clay, and a lot of the Italian firms didn't. They used plaster. And that was kind of interesting. I mean, there's the dust from the plaster, but it was like, you know, you kind of felt close to Michelangelo.
So basically you were sculpting it like
they
with a hammer
away. And you could add more plaster to it, but they were very much like sculptors from centuries ago. I mean, it was
right.
It was kind of cool.
I visited Bertone once, and I was surprised to see them using plaster. And I said, what are you using plaster for? They go, because now management cannot come in and change the design.
Yeah. that's...
And it's not as flexible as clay.
That's true. Yeah, yeah.
I always liked that. Hey, we got a number of phone calls coming in. Carmen, let's bring in one of them.
Hello, this is Brenton calling from Portsmouth, Virginia. I was just wondering if it's harder to design a car with no grill or with a grill, and then that's in regards to EVs. A lot of EVs don't really require a functioning grill. And John, you've mentioned before that you don't really see the need for a grill on an electric car, which makes a lot of sense. So I was just curious to know if it's without the lack of a grill or the need of a grill, is it harder to design a car or easier to design a car? Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks. Good question.
Yeah, it's, boy, we could talk for an hour about it. You know, the evolution of the front of a car from just a radiator sitting up there to a decorated radiator to something that became more of a grill in front of the radiator. And as radiators have changed, you know, grills have changed, but grills are part of the face of a car, you know, it's part of the identity. It's how you separate a BMW from a Mercedes, actually by the shape of the grill. And in many cases, the radiators isn't right behind that grill. It may be lower in a different position, but that grill is, you know, part of the graphic identity. It's kind of interesting to see a Tesla with no grill at all. And it's a little strange, you know, because it's blank, but that's now become part of their identity. And you think about it. I mean, a Corvette doesn't have a conventional grill, but it's taking... You know, it's got air intakes and it cools in that regard. But I do think it's an important part of the identity of many brands.
I don't know. I think it's going, my own personal opinion is take it out another 10 years and anything with a radiator grill that's electric is going to look really old fashioned.
Possibly.
You know, recently, Infiniti just showed...
It depends on how you define a grill.
It does, yeah. And that's why I was just going to bring up. Infiniti, in their electric concept, has the outline of a grill, even though there's no grill there.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I've seen Ford's electric Mustang-inspired it's about to come. Same kind of thing. There's the hint of a grill without having one,
right.
Unlike the Jaguar I-Pace, the Audi e-tron... And the other German luxury brands or European luxury that are coming out with electric cars that have got radiator grills.
Yes, yeah, yeah. The Chevy Bolt, you know, there's a graphic, but it's not really a grill. It's more a graphic statement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What is your sense of the design of Teslas, which seem to have been so well accepted by people? I mean, you know, the head designer there used to work for you.
I think they've been... Well done, you know, in particular exterior more than the interior. The interior, the design might be good, but the materials, you know, there's room for improvement there with materials, I'd say. But their designs have been good. They've been very clean, very confident look about them.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what do you think? Grill or no grill, and Tesla in particular?
I think it'll be a brand-by-brand thing. I think that the brand that crafts an identity, even without a grill, but still presents a brand face, I think that's important. And however it transitions to full electric, I think you're going to need some facial identity. to the product.
Right.
I really do.
I mean, there's some cars that that are so over the top with their front-end graphics. It's just unbelievable. Just, you know, I'm a big fan of Darth Vader, but I wouldn't want the front of my car to look like his nose. I mean...
Gary, any thoughts yourself? Grill, no grill, Tesla in general?
Well, I mean, I think that basically as we have technological developments, that we're going to have to reflect the change in the technology, in the design. I mean, the form follows function sort of thing. I mean, we wouldn't have a dial on the face of our iPhones, right?
I mean, well, I could see a front end that's blank, except at night. When you can, LED projections of some sort.
Funny you mentioned that. We just got a comment here from Aussie2U, and he says, the grills will soon be screens, wrappable and changeable screens. They can appear to be anything you want. Do you see that happening, Ed?
They could as long as they meet, I hate to throw cold water on it, but if they meet federal guidelines, you know, with what you can do in lighting, if that's considered lighting. If it's not considered lighting, then maybe it's okay. But, yeah, there's a fine line there. I just think that a brand needs to have a clear identity, particularly in a very competitive market. It has to have an identity. It doesn't mean it has to be a grill. It doesn't mean it has to be some kind of, you know, intake or whatever. But having an identity, I think, is important.
So of the design cues that differentiate one vehicle from another? I mean, is historically at least the grill
grill's
that,
been a
that
big
element
part of it? Yes, yeah, probably more so than now. You know, it's. I mean, I can envision some of those old illustrations that just showed all these grills lined up, and you could tell the brands by the grills,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Levante A just wrote in to say, I just bought the new iPad Pro 12.9. I've been sketching on it like crazy.
Ah, that's cool. Yeah.
You like very sketching
cool.
with a pad?
Yeah, I do.
It's amazing how tactile it looks, even though it doesn't feel that, right? But it looks that way.
Yeah, I like it. I still like, you know, and it depends on the pen or pencil on paper, on vellum. I like vellum. Yeah.
You can hear it. I mean,
you can hear it. And if it's vellum, you can work the front and the back of the paper. And it's just getting your hands into it. That's really cool.
And what is your
sense? That particular tablet's cool, though. It's
cool. Yeah.
Given your history and looking back over the years, are we in a good place in terms of automotive design? Or are we going to go to a better place? I mean, how do you see this? Some people say we're in a golden age right now.
I think the golden age is to come. There have been golden ages. And I would say right now, I'm very concerned about some of the reckless, scarred-up-looking cars and SUVs that I see that look like they're in a knife fight and lost. I wouldn't consider that part of a golden age.
A lot of busy design.
Busy design doesn't work for me.
So when you envision a golden age, what do you...
If in fact, busy design generally gets dated quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It gets dated quickly. A cleaner design is far more timeless.
Before I set you off, Miro Keffert wrote in to say, Avanti and Citroën, great no-grill examples. Citroën DS.
Yeah. And in both cases, thank you for bringing that to our attention, because in both cases, the front ends look complete. They look complete, and they had a very clear identity. You knew what it was, and you knew, you know, the Avanti and the Citroën did not look the same. They looked quite different from each other. And I thought it worked.
Up there right now.
Yeah.
Some of the modern Citroën concepts have been gorgeous.
Concepts?
Yeah.
concepts. Yeah, it's a clear.
Yeah, I wish they could. You know, yeah. Peugeot also does fantastic concepts.
They just don't
get that stuff into production, though.
No, just a huge void.
So you mentioned we might yet be on the verge of a golden age. Where do you see us going in that regard?
I've been thinking more about vehicle types than the actual design language and how vehicle types will evolve, you know, because everyone talks about the whole sedan crisis is going away and SUVs are huge. It's, for me, I think about, that's what's next. What is next? It is my hope that the design language will be a cleaner aesthetic than what I see.
Bring back the sheer look.
You know.
As Bill Mitchell called it.
Yeah. But that's a good question. I have to think about that a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as we talked earlier, interiors with autonomy.
Yeah.
Now you can go anywhere you want.
So when is a car magazine going to put an interior on the cover? That is the one thing that I was pushing for that I couldn't get done when I was at GM.
My guess is they've tried it, and magazine stand sales went nowhere. They put another red Corvette on the cover.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just, you know, you never see an interior on the cover.
Interior is, to me, almost crucial. It's where you spend all your time.
Exactly.
It gives you a sense and a feel that, you know.
As important as they are and as, you know, and the work that goes into it. It's an incredible job doing an interior.
But isn't it, you know, the case that it's the exterior that brings you there?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
because you could have you know, the world's most ugly house that has the most sensational interior, but you're never going to go through the front door because you're like, oh.
Yeah, no, the exterior draws you in.
Yeah, that's.
And then the interior pays off the brand.
Exactly.
Hey, here's a good one. Levante A. wrote it back to say, I'm currently a junior in high school, and I always wanted to be a car designer since I was 8 years old. Which college do you recommend I go to? I live in Missouri.
Live in Missouri. Well, I'd still recommend CCS.
It's in Detroit.
Here in Detroit. It's a great school, but, you know, there are other schools. There's in Savannah is a good school, and in L.A., you know, with Art Center. But there are a number of schools I just... It's because I'm on the board at CCS. I can talk about it.
But I'd also say get good grades and apply for a scholarship because it ain't cheap.
Exactly. It's not cheap, and it's very competitive, and you need to have a strong portfolio to get
into
school.
Like I used to tell young creatives in the ad field, it doesn't matter how good your ideas are if you can't express them verbally.
Yeah.
You're going to be lost. So make sure you get that part of your education.
Well, you know the old joke, you know, what's the difference between an extroverted designer and an introverted one? An introverted one looks at his shoes when he talks to you. An extroverted one looks at your shoes.
Yes. Reminds me of a Mitchell story that we can tell later.
Okay, we'll think about that. And we got another phone call here. Carmen, let's bring that one in.
Hi, everyone. This is Alexander Karabitsis. Ed, I know that a while back GM had intended on producing a production version of the Cadillac CL concept, but then canceled it. I'm curious as to what that vehicle would have been like. Would it have been a large sedan, four-door convertible like the concept, or something else entirely?
Yeah. Production version of the CL.
Or we'd have some sort of
CL was a very strong concept. There was never any consideration for a production version of that car as it was. A four-door convertible is tough, if not impossible. With
these days.
Yeah, these days with side impact.
And rollover.
Rollover as well, but side impact primarily.
And, here's a picture of it.
And then the mass. The car did have a very healthy influence on the work in the studio, and I really think it paid for itself its existence. It really,
you got those blade headlamps out of this, right?
Yeah, it did. And some of the surfaces, you know, the car was going from being as much a folded, you know, sheet metal to something that had a lot more flow and shape, and the interior had an influence as well. So, no, it didn't go in production, but I think it really helped the studio team quite a bit.
Oh, yeah, you had the CL and you had the El Mirage.
Yeah, El Mirage.
And then the Escala.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing I liked about the CL, the coolest thing I thought about the car was for the backseat passengers, because it's a convertible. If it was a cool day, you had a retractable cashmere blanket or shawl that you could pull out and wrap around yourself. I thought that was the coolest thing.
Well, you know, that's why concept cars are so cool, because that's what people want to see.
Right.
That's why the Detroit, this recent Detroit show is kind of a letdown for
me. What about that, Ed? I mean, concept cars, the public loves them.
Yes.
They're very expensive to do, though.
Yes, they are.
I mean, we don't see very many anymore. Is that going to be an ongoing trend that we don't see many?
I don't know that it will. I think that, you know, Infiniti had a couple good concepts there. Really, and a wonderful interior in the SUV concept that they had. I guess it's an SUV. But will we see more? You know, it seems to go in cycles, waves.
Yeah.
And, you know, where we have a lot and then we don't. At least at General Motors, the feeling was if you have new production introductions, you don't want a concept car to get in the way of it, or to steal the limelight from a production introduction. And there's so many production introductions now that, you know, there isn't quite the room for concepts. And the design studios and engineering labs are so busy working on production cars, it's tough to find the time.
Do you have to make them drivers, though? I mean, I would think that you could do a car as a pure design concept that
They
doesn't have to drive.
No, they don't have to drive. In some cases, they don't. And some of them, they barely move. They, you know, there's an electric motor and they drive at. And the effect, the motion, is always exciting. There are actually some, you know, there's some virtual concepts now that they never actually build the physical model. But when you see the design, it's really kind of cool. It's stimulating. I think it does a bit for the brand to show some of the virtual concepts. So I think going forward, we'll just have to look at different ways of connecting with customers and with journalists alike.
So what's your sense of the future of auto shows?
The potential's there for something exciting. You know, I was thinking the other day, I've been to so many shows, you know, and everyone, you know, within the industry, they're at Frankfurt and Shanghai and Geneva and Detroit, New York to some degree. But I've been to shows like Bogota, Colombia, Argentina, you know, and Thailand and shows around the world. I think, you know, it depends on who your audience is. Is it customers or is it, you know, media? Is it the industry? And I think that affects what the future is for an auto show. I think auto shows in the 1950s, they were like a fantasy land for people. You know, really were.
The Motorama.
The colors, the energy, the bands, the dancers, the cutaway models and all of that. And so I think late 50s would have been the height of that, on into the 60s. And then they started to become far more dealer shows. And I think, frankly, some of the dealerships have grown so that, you know, you can see just as nice a show if you go to a dealership as going to the auto show. I do think there's a potential for something very exciting going forward, but it would have to have a bit more fantasy.
Get back to what it was in the 50s.
Yeah, it's just like we were saying earlier. I mean, it'll go full circle, but it won't be the same. It'll be very different from the 50s, but it's got to have that fantasy. It's got to have something that excites kids, draws them in. And what is that? What would excite them? Is it more digital? Is it more, you know, what is it? I still think the ability to ride on a ride or be entertained in some way is important. Yeah.
So
just moving it to a warmer time of year isn't enough.
Right.
You've got to reinvent it. Yeah.
But I wonder, is the auto industry going to be the same aspirational sort of thing that it was back then with the, you know, the post-World War II generation that, you know, the kids are looking at this stuff and it's like, wow, this is what the future is going to be like. And, you know, as Peter was saying, you know, you had the Motorama and it would be like, yeah, you know, there's going to be, you know, autonomous cars and flying cars and whatnot. I mean, and I just wonder whether, do you have the feeling that there is sufficient enthusiasm that young people have about cars?
I think it has the potential of being incredibly exciting and would really connect with the young people. Will it? I don't know. But the potential's there. It certainly is there. And young people may not be excited, or a lot of them, in today's automobiles. But I think the right vehicles, the right type of vehicles, it could be incredibly exciting.
I totally.
And it may be something totally different than what, you know, today's car guys like.
I totally agree. I think Tesla has tapped into that. Mm. You know, it's a much younger demographic that's interested in that. And I keep saying, once we get to full autonomy,
yeah,
and a new generation realizes that they can do whatever they want in these vehicles,
exactly,
they're going to be the ultimate party machines. They are going to become super popular again.
I mean, a party for people of all ages.
Yeah. Hey, we got another phone call. We're getting down to the end of the show, but let's make this the last of them. Let's bring that one in, Carmen.
Yeah, hi. This is John Duffy from South Carolina. I'd like to have Ed speak.
We're not hearing it out here.
So I'm
impressed and like to get his thoughts. Thank you very much.
Carmen, we didn't get the audio here in the studio. And what was his name?
John Duffy.
Okay, John Duffy from South Carolina. We're having a technical issue not getting the audio in here. He wants to know, what do you think about Audi's design?
Oh, they're strong. You know, I don't think they really stand out. And I think their customer, you know, they're doing what I think their customer wants. It's something that, boy, it's got to be tough for their designers to monitor. How far do you reach? How far do you move with that? How do you keep it fresh and stay within that mode that they're in? Their cars, they're kind of invisible to me. I don't really...
Didn't used to be that way, but yeah, I would agree.
Yeah.
And their new e-tron electric SUV is like, eh.
It looks like something that they've already got out.
Yeah, exactly. It's
better than the Mercedes,
Well executed, but they don't make that strong a statement.
Yeah, especially their lower level cars.
Yeah,
you know,
are
just sort of blend into the back. Part of the reason too is so many people have been copying them that they don't stand out like they used to.
But some of the people who have copied them have copied them and then added a little twist to it.
True. Here's the picture of the e-tron, and you can see that the big grill, which I think just is going to look so old fashioned in no time.
Look at that.
which brand excites you?
I have been and continue to be a fan of Aston Martin. I really like what they do. Yeah, even looking past the price point, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at designs and not necessarily what they cost or even, you know, the powertrain within them. I like the work they do. I mentioned Volvo earlier. And I'm just talking about brands other than General Motors because I've got all kinds of prejudice within there. But those, Those excite me.
So one very exclusive and one basically mainstream?
Yeah.
Well, a little bit premium. Volvo is premium.
But accessible.
Some of the work from Kia I like, you know. The Infiniti Concepts I like. Yeah.
What'd you think of the Kia Telluride?
That's their big three-row SUV. And there's the Hyundai Palisade. Cousin V.
I think the Kia Telluride was much nicer than the Palisade.
Yeah.
Palisade.
I don't know him well enough to.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on in the front end of the Palisade. But yeah.
Here's a.
That's a Kia.
Kia. Well, you know, Schreier was there. Now he's head of both Hyundai Kia. And isn't it. Who's doing the Kia design now? Is that Luke Donkervalk is heading that, and he's going to replace Schreier, I think, at the end of the year? But, Kia, all they got to do is change that oval logo of theirs. To me, that looks very dated. It was copied on the Ford oval anyway, but the rest of their designs, I think, are pretty good.
Yeah.
Hey, we're going to have to wrap up the show here, but Ed Welburn, it's been really good having you on the show.
It's been good.
Really good.
Time went by fast.
It does. It really does.
Really fast.
Yeah. Peter, great having you here.
Glad to be here.
As always. Gary, great to be back in the studio with you again.
Absolutely.
And, of course, we want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.
Don't look at your seat. You can tell you don't have a taste. Don't ever give an opinion on one of our designs.
Well, here, we'll do this rapid fire, and you guys can all jump in, too. Philo Farnsworth says, a factual story about the Pontiac Aztec without bashing it would be interesting to hear.
Let's not forget that the original concept was quite good.
Yeah.
And it was the forerunner of the packaging we see in all kinds
of
SUVs now.
It's very much where the industry is today.
Yeah. And so the original concept was quite good.
Yeah.
The problem was there was a huge excitement about it at the Detroit show. And the problem was GM they weren't going to do a bespoke architecture for it. So they said, what can we put it on to get it to the market quickest? Well,
I'll tell you my story.
Go ahead.
Because I was on the launch of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. Mark Royce was chief engineer on that vehicle.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm driving with him at the media launch, and I said, Mark, no disrespect, how do you end up something that looks like this? He goes, hey, I washed my hands of this. This is what design did. So I went to Wayne Cherry, and I said, Wayne, why did it end up looking like this? He says, I washed my hands of it. This is what manufacturing said we had to build it on, the minivan out of Europe architecture. Or I guess it wasn't out of Europe, but the minivan.
Well,
I went to Hackworth, and I said, why did you guys say that it had to be on the minivan? He goes, hey, I washed my hands of it. This is what finance said we had to use. And that's when I realized no one was in charge.
The deal was, and I firmly believe, and this is the way I always operate, you had to have a clear common vision for whatever it is you're doing, whether it's designing a car or, you know, creating a marketing plan or whatever. You need a clear vision for what you're doing. With that vehicle, design had their vision for this off-road vehicle with huge personality. Engineering had their vision, which meant it was going to come off of a car architecture, basically. Marketing had their vision of all kinds of camping and tents and all of that. They all had their separate visions, and the car suffered. And I firmly believe, I don't know, I think I don't know that everyone really learned lessons from it, but today you wouldn't see that kind of splintered vision for a vehicle.
Yeah.
That was it. I mean, because some of those same people went on to do some really good work.
Yeah.
The chief designer of that did the C7.
Oh, no kidding.
Was it? In a very different environment, different culture. Yeah.
SubGR77 wants to know, what do you think about the Rivian vehicles, especially the front end? You feel Rivian's the new electric startup based here in Michigan.
Yeah.
They showed a pickup and an SUV.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know the vehicle.
Peter, what do you think? Rivian.
I think it's a real distinctive front end, very new looking.
Here's a picture of it. I'm a little bit taken by those vertical oval lamps in front. Yeah. But it is a very distinctive look. It's a very clean design.
Very well executed. The whole design is very well executed all the way around, including the front end. It's an unusual front. It reminds me of some Italian designs from the 1980s. So it has a very Italian look about it.
It's a nice design signature.
Yeah.
Bring it to market that way.
Yeah. I guess the challenge would be, though, if you have a design that looks so exotic and you're a brand no one has ever heard of before, and, oh, by the way, you're also an electric vehicle, what is the likelihood that you're going to get, you know, sufficient traction in the market?
That's the same thing that happened with Tesla.
Yeah.
So they have an opportunity.
Yeah. In this case, as soon as I saw the image, I thought of Land Rover because of the proportions, the silhouette of the vehicle, the shape of the upper and the rear, and even the blacked out A pillars and B pillars are very much with that brand. So, I mean, they pretty much used it as their guide and then put a very fresh, very unique front end that will stand out. Yeah.
Okay, HyperRide wants to know, what do you think about the cars from the Brougham era? Classic chrome-clad wire wheel, white wall, vinyl roof-covered cars from Cadillac, Lincoln, and Chrysler.
Yeah. I don't really care for them. They really hurt many of those brands. In all cases, though, there was a clean version of them. If you look at the Eldorado or the Riviera from that period, there was a clean version without the Landau top and all that stuff troweled on the car. That was actually quite nice.
Right.
I never saw one of the Chryslers without all that stuff on it, but, you know. Yeah.
Whip Good says, what about a Sonic-based Fiero? You know, the Fieros still look good.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, they don't look all that dated, even though they're 30 years old or whatever.
Right, yeah, they are. Yeah, Fiero. I hadn't thought about it. I thought the Fiero, and then they had a more of a fastback version.
Fastback,
yeah,
with the V6.
Which was very cool.
It was actually, that was the early version.
The regular one.
The later version of it was good. And
I worked on the launch of that car.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Just when they got it just right, they killed it.
Yeah, but GM has a history of that.
Yeah, they sure do.
They develop the car in market and get it to the point where it's good, and then it's just, we're going another direction.
Oh, and they were selling over 30,000 units a year when they dropped it.
Yeah. Mac Murphy says, what was the best design that never happened? Was that the H4, the HX?
HX? That'd be pretty high on the list.
I'll never forget.
A couple of the Cadillac concepts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Never forget going to the HXX studio. Young designers, I mean, it just felt so alive, and that was terribly disappointing. And, well, the Cadillacs, I mean, El Mirage. I mean, I know it's influenced the look of the production cars.
Yeah, there it is.
G- God, that looks cool.
The detail.
That would be so hot today.
It still looks good.
Yeah.
And that was quite a few years
ago. Yeah, and the detailing on that was just fantastic.
And then the potential for derivatives and brand extensions. Oh, you I can see. You can imagine the clothes that could go along with that, the boots, the jackets. Yeah.
Jeep is cashing in on that now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Jeep moved their designs to, Hummer influenced the hell out of Jeep. They'd never admit it because they'd say, oh, no, Jeep influenced Hummer. But, you know, you're seeing a lot of Hummer in the the new Wranglers and stuff.
Yeah. Sofer says, were there any vehicles you designed that had elements, design elements you wanted, but the engineer said couldn't be implemented?
That was always the case. I think at the time that we did that 1988 Cutlass Supreme, we wanted flush glass all the way around. You couldn't do it. Audi was doing it. It was spreading throughout VW, and everyone else is trying to do it, and you just couldn't get there with it. That's the one that comes to mind right away. But there are always those challenges. The thing is, I think if you create a vision model early enough, if you give engineers enough time, they can do just about anything. But when you don't make up your mind on what you want from a design perspective until late, then the whole, I guess, window of opportunity becomes a lot smaller.
Did it get better
over the years? That's
good advice. That they ended up being more receptive to doing things?
It got better as we were letting them know what we were looking for from a design perspective earlier. The earlier you did it, the easier it was for them to get on board.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mark Tilton from Tucson, Arizona, wrote in. He said, Ed, I worked at Sewell Village Cadillac in the late 70s. A short 30 years later, at a new car show, I went to the Cadillac display. I wanted to have the new car leather smell. It was gone. Where did it go and why?
I don't know. You guys may have a better answer for that than I do, other than, you know, there's...
Well, the only thing I've heard is that in China, they don't like it, so they purge the smells from the interior.
That's true, but I think an awful lot that has been done to treat leather to make it durable has taken away a lot of the leather
smell. Right. No, to prevent UV degradation and drying out, it is so treated.
Right.
There are a few. Jaguar tends to have good-smelling leather in its cars, and Bentley does too, but it's very high-end. If you want leather that's going to look good...
I wonder if it's actually the leather or something that they've added somewhere in the car.
It was always the case that, you know, most of the new car smell is actually the plastics off-gassing.
Oh, yeah. Paint, glue.
So it was that sort of thing. And, you know, and to the point of the leather, I mean, maybe it's like one of those things where, you know, it probably really wasn't that good a smell, but we remember it with certain nostalgia, and we think...
Yeah. But you're right about China. They really don't like that smell. Yes.
And the reason is, you know, if you've been in any Chinese city, they stink in a lot of places. You know, you get off the beaten path a little bit, and... The sewage smell and pollution.
Where?
Oh, Beijing, man. Come on.
It's off the beat.
And so Chinese people.
Yeah, Beijing is pretty difficult.
They get in a car. They don't want to smell all this plastic and glue.
I'm a big fan of China, but you're right. You're right. Beijing is.
In fact, you know, Geely, having bought Volvo and are, you know, trying to borrow ideas without stealing, you know, design and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
But Geely says getting in our cars is like being in Scandinavia. We've got air purification. We don't have any of the new cars.
Sure.
One of the ways they're selling their car is get in our car. It's so clean and doesn't stink.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, James Crabtree from Newcastle, Indiana says, I'd like to know your thoughts, Ed, on why there was a change from bench seats to split seats to incorporate a center console, even in pickup trucks, and if front benches could or should ever make a comeback.
There's some available in pickups, you know, more work trucks than personal use. Customers like to have a console that they can store a lot of their things in. It's customer preference, number one. There is a challenge in doing a bench seat in a sedan and doing it in a safe way with airbags that can really do their job effectively.
You know, I want to say a few years ago, Toyota offered an optional bench seat in the Camry. There were no takers.
Yeah, then
people didn't want it. Given the choice, they didn't want
it. Yeah. After all, where are you going to put your cup holders? And you joke about it, but boy, if you don't have effective big gulp cup holders easy at hand, then forget about it.
Yeah, I'm driving a Sierra right now, and the storage container in the center console is sized for a major appliance. So you just put it in there,
shut it,
good to go.
Eston Baja says, I'm a 2017 Chevrolet Bolt owner, love my Bolt. Can you give us any input on the Bolt program, and what can you say about future GM electric vehicles or even electric?
I can, other than the fact that, you know, they are really, it's a very high priority pushing forward with electric vehicles. Other than that, I really can't say.
Okay. Let's see. Brian Kim wants to know, what's the process within GM to get budget approval for a new model?
What? We don't have enough time for that.
yeah.
Okay.
I mean, but it is. I mean, I don't know how I can explain that easily.
Let's just say it's a lot more complicated than when Bill Mitchell would do a design and then summon the general managers and invite them to make a case to have it in their product lineup.
In some ways, it's less complicated than it was because everyone works together up front creating this common vision. And with a common vision, it's just a whole lot easier for everything else to happen. And, you know, you don't always get your way, but you know, it's certainly, in many ways, is easier. Yeah. Having a strong advocate for design helps. Yeah.
Who comes up with the names for concept cars?
Not me. I'd rather design it than name it. Naming it is very difficult. It's hard to find a name that hasn't already been, you know, tied up legally. It's very difficult.
Yeah, no kidding. These days, everything's been trademarked.
Yeah,
every river, every mountain.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Like what? CL or El Mirage or, I mean, who comes up with that?
It's generally It's marketing that comes up with it most of the time, and I gladly let them handle that. It's tough work. Hmm.
Well, we ought to wrap it up, but once again, really good. Good stuff.
Good.
Peter, great having you here.
Yes, good.
Both of you guys. And I hope everybody who was watching us live enjoyed the extra conversation.